Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Every year, millions of athletes, from the peewees to the pros, suffer sports-related concussions. Now, like other severe head traumas, concussions can affect memory, mental abilities, even the sense of self. But because the damage is rarely visible, a concussion is often dismissed as a simple bump on the head. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will explore the problem with two guests, Linda Carroll and David Rosner. Linda Carroll is a longtime contributing writer for MSNBC.com's health section. Her stories have also appeared in the New York Times, Health, and Smart Money. David Rosner is a longtime sports writer who's been a reporter at Newsday and also managing editor of a national magazine for neurology patients. The two of them are the authors of a recently published book. The title is The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. So if you would like to read on the subject, you can look for that book. And on the program this morning here, if you have questions, you can call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. You may also send us your thoughts, questions by email if you want to do that, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, you can call in and be a part of the conversation. And we'll say hello to our guests here. Ms. Carroll, hello.
Hi there.
And Mr. Rosner.
Hello.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today. This is something that, as you write about in the book, it's if we're talking about numbers, can be a little difficult to get a handle on, although apparently the Centers for Disease Control have tried to make some sort of estimates of the numbers of sports-related concussions that happen every year. What do they think?
Well, anybody's estimate is pretty much a guess, mm-hmm. but they're, they go up to as much as 3.8 million concussions a year, which is a lot, and that's just sports-related concussions.
And that seems to be an astounding number, but perhaps also that says something about, and we're talking here about not only it would be concussions sustained by professional athletes, but we also could be talking about children and adolescents, and maybe that says something about just how the opportunities for kids to play sports have grown so tremendously, and for girls particularly. So we got a lot of kids playing sports, and apparently we have having a lot of this type of injury.
Right. I mean, if you go to any playing field for a number of sports, you see kids out there having a good time and crashing into each other, crashing into goalposts, crashing into the ground. And often you get concussions if the collisions are hard.
And is it truly, I don't really remember when I was of that age, when I was doing that kind of crashing, there being so much discussion of the issue. Do you think that what we're looking at here is there is greater awareness, or could it really be that there actually are more of them?
Well, back in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, it's kind of the dark ages of concussion awareness, to the point where, when I started covering sports as a cub reporter in the 70s, it wasn't even on the radar. Mm. And every once in a while, you would see a serious head injury, but for the most part, nobody talked about concussions. They were dismissed. As bell ringers and dings, and it's only been really the 90s and especially the last few years, the past decade, where we now have the awareness that head injuries are not bell ringers. They're severe, potentially severe and definitely serious. Injuries.
Yeah, and I'm sure that has happened in large part because professional athletes, and I think mostly here we're talking about people who played football, professional football, and these athletes and their families have come forward and talked about illnesses and difficulties, mental and physical, that they have experienced later in life that they were certain that were the result of injuries when they were playing. So people are now really talking about this, I think, in a way that in the past they just didn't.
Right. That's especially with the long-term ramifications, the dementia and depression. That's a very recent realization in the last, 5-10 years,
mm-hmm.
especially the last few years, realizing that what used to be thought of as something that just was seen in boxers, where you expect punch drunk syndrome, and now you started seeing it in football players, hockey players, and that has, of course, scared everyone.
Yeah. Well, and I think also it's something that's really kind of sobering, and I guess it would give you pause if you were a parent and had a child who played sports, is that, to me, at least the thing that's really sobering is that things that we think of as non-contact sports, things like basketball and soccer, although certainly on soccer field people can crash into each other, about how there are concussions related to those sports. And further, the thing I think that's really striking is that girls, you'd think maybe the problem would be boys playing football, but we're really seeing some serious issues with concussions in girls playing basketball and soccer.
Yeah, well, I think, people don't think of girls as playing hard. Whereas it's my experience, having grown up as a girl, played sports, that girls are every bit as macho when they're out on the playing field. And you have to understand that the concussions occur often as a result of a collision. So two players are running full tilt at each other. They run into each other and they stop and their brains don't. One of the things I think of is it's like being in a car without a seatbelt. Your car stops, but just like your body going through the windshield, your brain just keeps going and, smashes into your skull. And in that process, there's some twisting and ripping of the cells in your brain that you're not necessarily aware is happening. You have these symptoms, and sometimes they're very subtle, but it's the collisions, and I see them. My daughter plays soccer. She's 8, and I see kids crashing into each other all the time.
Yeah. And here, I think one of the points that you make, I think is important, and David was just talking about how, what we've seen these cases of professional athletes that later in life were developing dementia or other mental difficulties that seem pretty clearly related to their playing experience. And so you could no doubt see that you have a serious cumulative effect. Like if you get hit over and over and over again, it's going to be worse than if you just get hit once.
Right.
But I guess there's good reason. So there's reason to be concerned about cumulative effect no matter who you're talking about. But there's particular reason to be concerned about cumulative effect of hits in children, right?
Right. Well, young brains aren't finished, and they're a little more vulnerable than older brains are. And so if all those hits to a kid potentially can have a much greater effect than a lot of hits to a mature brain.
And also kids
are like still, they're in school, they're developing, and you can completely derail a kid's academic career.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. Why don't I bring them into the conversation, and I guess I'll take here the opportunity to introduce again the guests, Linda Carroll and David Rosner. They're the co-authors of a recently published book that's titled The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, that looks at sports-related concussions, something that is, I think some people would argue, is just beginning to get overdue attention. Because it's something really to be concerned about, particularly for children, but for athletes of any age. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Champaign. Let's talk with them, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A great topic. I can tell you, as a father of an 11-year-old girl who plays basketball and baseball and tried a little bit of football, girls play every bit as hard as boys, and it's fantastic. I don't know. But anyway, the reason I was calling, two topics for your guest to speak on, was wondering if they could speak with regards to the inverse relationship as to equipment today. And what I'm talking about primarily is football. And what I mean is today's players obviously are bigger, faster, stronger, and their equipment is better, more protective on the surface, whereas it enables the players to not perhaps intentionally, but to make plays or to use their equipment maybe unintentionally almost as weapons, because the equipment is so much better and stronger and can inflict, obviously, a lot more serious injuries. Whereas back in the 20s and 30s when they used to put leather caps on their head, you know, maybe they didn't play with such abandon or the injuries weren't as so life-threatening. And then the other topic would be just the coaching techniques where at a very young age, and I've witnessed this myself, you know, the players are taught, you know, tough it out, be tough, you know, take the hits, you know, get your opponent, this kind of thing, you know, really no forethought to possible injuries at such a delicate age. And I'll go ahead and listen off here, thanks.
Okay, I appreciate the questions. Maybe we'd take them in the other order,
right.
Just because I think that, and you certainly make a point of talking about that very thing, that that maybe part of the problem is that, indeed, coaches and maybe even sometimes parents are telling these athletes, whatever their age, that, you know, they're telling them, you know, you're fine. Get up there, get up and get up back out there and play. And that's may have contributed to the problem.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, for, you know, it's I understand that, you know, coaches and parents see this injury that you really can't see. You know, kids crash into each other and maybe they look a little woozy, but you really can't see that there's anything wrong with them. They get up, they walk away, and because of that, it's easy to make light of it. I mean, but even in our more enlightened phase that we're in right now, I've been amazed to watch kids on the playing field, you know, with eight-year-olds who, you know, who will collide into each other, you know, in my kids' soccer practice, and, you know, you'll see a kid crying, grabbing their head, and you see the coach saying, come on, get over it, it's no big deal, get back in there. And so even in our age of enlightenment, you've got coaches who still are teaching these kids that they should be tough and they should ignore the symptoms and just get right back out there and play.
Yeah. And I suppose that partly that does, I'm sure, sometimes come from coaches, but I imagine there are probably also some players who want to be back out there. And, you know, maybe they say, look, I'm okay. And maybe they feel like they're okay. So they're, in some sense, they're doing that themselves. They're saying, no, I'm fine. I'm ready to go. And maybe then the problem is that the coach is taking them at their word and saying, well, all right, if you feel you're okay, fine, go.
Well, I think there's a component of that, too. I mean, you know, kids are very competitive. They bond with their team members. They don't want to let their team down. And if they don't really see that this could change their lives, and maybe even if they did, you know, mm-hmm. if they're very good at denial and they feel invincible, you know, they just want to get back out there. And especially, you know, adolescents, you know, they're going to lie about the injury. You know, I'm fine. Let me out there.
Yeah. Well, what about the other issue, which I know people have raised this question over the years. They say, well, you know, the technology, particularly in football, there's been a lot of work applied to the protection that players wear, helmets, I guess, particularly, and that has maybe helped with injury issues for the players who are wearing the stuff, but that also means that they're maybe it's more, there's a greater possibility of them to inflict injuries on others that somehow have to do with the stuff that they're wearing to protect themselves. Is that an issue?
Well, the irony is that helmets were instituted in football to protect against skull fractures and serious head injuries and have had the opposite effect in terms of concussions they don't protect against, they can't protect the brain from sloshing into the skull, and it does create, you know, the technological advances in all equipment has created a sense of invulnerability among the players. It's an issue, you know, you've heard in the NFL and the NHL now, that the increased armor has enabled players to you know use the equipment as weapons or as to create a veneer of invulnerability.
Yeah, and I suppose you couple that with the fact that players are bigger, stronger, faster. That just seems to compound the potential for injuries.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the force with which you hit somebody has got to do with this, you know, the rate at which you're moving, and your weight and your mass. And so the bigger the player, the more force behind the hit. You know, and you get players now who think that their heads are protected and they can use their heads like they're battering rams, and they'll just launch into one another. And they're not just hurting the player they're hitting, they're hurting themselves in the process because their heads hit something and their brains keep going. So you get the same effect. You know, both players are getting hurt.
The one of the problems here is that, as you've suggested, and you certainly write about in the book, one of the problems here is that we have something that is the concussion where there may not be any real strong visible signs of injury, and you can't do an X-ray and find out whether someone has had a concussion. You can't do a brain scan and find out whether someone has had a concussion. Why is it this is so difficult to diagnose?
Well, you know, because you can't. I mean, with traditional scanning technologies, CAT scans, MRIs. You know, the concussion doesn't show up, and scientists think the main reason for that is that the damage to the brain is kind of scattered throughout the brain. It's not concentrated in one place. So you've got many, many, many cells that are being ripped apart or stretched, and they're not, you know, you'll have a healthy cell next to an unhealthy cell, and you're only going to see something on a brain scan if you've got a lot of cells that are damaged in the same place. You know, so unless you pick up on symptoms, you're not going to be able to diagnose the concussion.
Well, then I guess the natural question you hear from me to ask is, what are the symptoms?
There's a lot of symptoms. But, I mean, one of the most common symptoms is headache. But you might also have a moment of dizziness or fogginess. You know, and the symptoms can be short-lived or they can be stick around. You know, you can some kids end up with balance problems, and you know, you might see, if you're a parent, you might notice that your kid is a little slow. You know, they might not speak as quickly. They might be slurred. You know, they look a little uncoordinated, you know, or just, you know, simply they just don't remember, like, say, what happened right before they hit their head or right after they developed those kinds of memory problems.
Mm-hmm.
You might also get, you know, kind of nausea symptoms.
And is it possible that you could, say right after the event, you could be experiencing some symptoms, but that they could kind of go away or could diminish, and that maybe sometime later symptoms could come back?
Yeah, it's not uncommon for someone to have a concussion on the field, think they're okay, and then the next day have much more intense symptoms.
Hmm.
I mean, one of the girls we write about in the book was a cheerleader, and she fell during a stunt, practicing a stunt, and apparently she went right back to practice after she hit her chin. She was a little bloodied, but they cleaned her up. She went right back doing the stunt. And the next day, she was miserable. But the day it happened, she just went along with her day normally.
Hmm.
I mean, and her concussion was so bad that it took about a year for her to rehab back.
So what, in terms of treatment, what can doctors offer to people who have experienced concussion?
Well, I think, you know, for most people, what works is complete cessation of activity, both, you know, physical activity and mental activity. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be thinking, because that's making your brain do work too. So, you know, maybe a week for some kids, maybe 3 weeks for other kids. But, you know, you have to be very quiet until your symptoms have all gone away. I mean, there are, and then there's, you know, some percentage, and nobody seems to know exactly what the percentage is, but there is some percentage that takes a lot longer to get better.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's not really complicated, but what we're talking about is what might be a prolonged period of physical and mental rest.
Right, right. I mean, and it's you know, if you break your ankle, you know, everybody understands you can't go out and walk on it, you know, but people who hurt their brains think that they can just go back to doing what they were doing. You know, you have to let your brain convalesce.
Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just introduce, are Linda Carroll and David Rosner. Linda Carroll is a longtime contributing writer for MSNBC.com's health section. David Rosner is a longtime sports writer. He's been a reporter at Newsday, also managing editor of a national magazine for neurology patients. They are the co-authors of a recent book that is titled The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. That's published by Simon & Schuster. So if you're interested in the subject, you can look at the book. Questions welcome. We got somebody here ready to go. Others are certainly welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks very much. Our son is about 19 months out from a soccer concussion, and I wondered if you could speak to the interaction between the concussion and long-term concussion symptoms and the sort of pharmaceutical approach to treating these. It seems like there's been quite a lot of experimentation with various drugs to deal with concussion symptoms, and those have their own complicating factors that can then interact with dealing with the whole cognitive academic side of things, as well as the emotional recovery from not only the concussion but also the changing way of life for a kid coming out of sports and having to find a sort of new pursuits. So I guess the question is really navigating the medical, the pharmaceutical treatment options. Any ideas you have for parents and for those dealing with this issue?
Okay, great. Thanks for the question. Well, Linda, David, how do you want to take that on?
Well, I think that, you know, ground is still being broken on this topic. You know, I mean, what's happened is in the centers that are specifically dealing with concussions, they have, you know, they have followed the example of, you know, drug therapies for severe brain injuries, you know, with some success. You know, it depends, I guess, on, you know, the patient, what drugs work. But what they try to do for somebody who's got lingering symptoms is to try to treat the symptoms themselves. You know, the best thing seems to be if the person has headaches, to give them something that will help with the headaches. If they have sleep problems, you address the sleep. And it seems that the more normal you can get someone, the quicker they recover.
And are there particular kind of medications that are used or thought to be helpful?
A number of medications, but not being a doctor, I can't, you know, tell you exactly which ones.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, and if my daughter had a severe concussion and she wasn't recovering, I would find the best concussion clinic I could and take her there, you know, because this is an area that's changing so rapidly that, you know, you really want someone who's on the forefront, who knows what the latest research is on medications.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's changing on a month-to-month basis as far as what is the best therapy for people's concussion symptoms.
All right. We'll hope that offers some help to the caller. Other people, again, who are listening, you can call in. One point I think that I'd like to have you talk about is that, well, sort of two things. One, that what researchers have discovered now is that if someone has a serious concussion and it's not allowed to heal, sometime later, if you have another one, the effects can be really profound.
Yeah, I mean, and it's particularly a problem for adolescents and younger kids, because you can have something that's deadly called second impact syndrome, where the first concussion pretty much throws your brain out of whack. You know, a lot of stuff is still going on in your brain, making it very vulnerable to a second hit. I mean, and there have been kids who have died on the playing field as a result of a second hit that didn't even look very hard. But their brain had been set up by this first hit, and the second one just sort of is the straw that pushes everything over the edge. and, you know, in older people, you can get something like that, but it's not as severe. But that second concussion can throw you into a situation where you have post-concussion syndrome, which is very hard to kind of climb back out of.
Mm-hmm. What is there also an issue with perhaps someone who is having repeated hits? Now, maybe in this case, they would seem less severe, or maybe that person wouldn't really be reporting any serious symptoms, or if there were, they would seem to be not too serious, and then maybe it would go away. But that if it just happens over and over and over again, that can be, even though each individual case maybe wouldn't be real severe, the cumulative effect would be something that would be really serious.
Well, you know, I think of it as kind of like, you know, and this is simplified, but I sort of think of it as, you know, scarring. You know, each time you hit the brain, you know, you do a little bit of damage, but it's not enough damage to really affect your life. But if you just keep doing that, then you end up with all that cumulative damage affecting you. I mean, one of the things that I have found the most amazing in covering brain science is in Parkinson's disease, which you actually can develop from getting too many hits, you can lose 80% of the nerve cells in a particular part of your brain and still be normal. And then once the 80% is gone, then all the symptoms start showing up. But the amazing thing is that your brain is fairly resilient, and it isn't until you've done a huge amount of damage that you hit this point of no return.
The so-called poster boys for that, the superstar players who kind of brought post-concussion syndrome into the public eye were Troy Aikman and Steve Young, the Hall of Fame quarterbacks,
mm-hmm.
who 10, 15 years ago experienced multiple concussions that ended their careers prematurely. And, you know, it was a situation where they were finding that they were getting concussed with, it took lighter hits to cause a concussion that would take longer for them to recover from. And again, that's the cumulative effect of having 10 diagnosed concussions in a career.
Mm.
So that's how we saw that phenomenon, you know, in public.
We're talking in this part of Focus about the problem of sports-related concussions. Our guest, Linda Carroll and David Rosner, authors of the book, The Concussion Crisis. I have another caller we'll get to right in a moment. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
I do so long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London.
Actor Gary Oldman is so good at what he does, you might not recognize him from role to role. From his campy portrayal of Dracula to Sirius Black in Harry Potter, and now George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Gary Oldman on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. We'll talk about his new book, Too Big to Know, as a long subtitle. It is Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. So it's about how knowledge and the search for knowledge has been changed, essentially, by the Internet. Then in hour two, the guest is Gar Alperovitz. He's a professor of political economy at University of Maryland, and we'll talk about his recent book, America Beyond Capitalism, which takes a look at some of what is wrong with America's economic and political system and how people are trying to work to change that on the grassroots level. Questions are certainly welcome, and you can check up on what we'll be doing by going to our website and get the schedule. That's will.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. In this hour, our guests are Linda Carroll and David Rosner. Linda Carroll is a longtime contributing writer for MSNBC.com's health section. Her stories have also appeared other places, New York Times, Health, Smart Money. David Rosner is a longtime sports writer. He's been a reporter at Newsday, also managing editor of a national magazine for neurology patients. And they are the co-authors of a newly published book. The title is The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic, published by Simon & Schuster, and looks at sports-related concussions. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have somebody here ready to go. Ivesdale, line one. Hello.
Good morning, all.
Yes.
I tuned in just a little bit late. You may have already covered it some, but I know you spoke about it a little bit. But I was curious about what types of symptoms in older age that you can come on with from cumulative concussions from earlier years, like, say, once you're middle-aged or on. If you suffered 8-10 concussions in a variety of severity throughout your life, what types of things you might be prone to, and what kind of symptoms, like, you know, being forgetful or short-term memory or things like that. That's my question, and I just wonder what kind of symptoms come on in older years. So I'll hang up and listen.
Great. Well, I thank you for the question. Can you answer that?
Yeah, eventually, you know, symptoms from too many concussions, which, you know, there's a name for the condition. It's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. If you follow somebody long enough, they start looking very much like someone who has Alzheimer's disease. But early on, you'll see some memory loss, and also often some behavior changes. People sometimes become very short-tempered, and, you know, they behave in ways that are different from the way they did before. But there is a lot of similarity after a while between this and Alzheimer's disease, which is why you sometimes see people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease who actually, you know, later on we find out they had chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
I'm curious about we're starting at least on the professional level, this issue is starting to get more attention, particularly when it comes to people who have played football. But I think also there have been particularly recently people have started to raise concerns about hockey, professional hockey, and I wonder whether you think that this is something that professionals in these sports or others have really begun to address. I mean, are they particularly pro football? Are they really stepping up on this issue, do you think?
Well, they came late to the party in terms of the NFL spent a lot of years starting in 1994 when the issue of post-concussion syndrome was starting to retire a few players early. And they spent years and years just studying it and denying that concussions had long-term effects, and you know, it's only been in the last couple of years, under a lot of pressure from the media, from Congress, from the medical community, that the NFL has started to take this very seriously and to make incremental changes, both to concussion protocols, how they're treated, how they're spotted, treated, and also to enforcing the rules against to limit head hits and exposure to them. But it's been an evolutionary kind of baby step process, both in the two big collision sports, football and hockey as well.
Mm. I can imagine some people saying, particularly when it comes to football, but maybe also for hockey, which can be pretty rough, people would say, well, you know, getting hit is just part of the game. And if you don't want to get hit, don't play. You know, if you're being paid big money, though, to play, that's just part of that's just part of the deal. Those are the conditions of work. And that there, I'm not exactly sure how you do something about that, that doesn't end up actually making it a different game.
Well, the first thing you have to know is that, you know, it's like the issue with smoking years ago. You know, you have to come to the realization that head injuries are, you know, serious, potentially life-changing injuries, and the understanding of that has only been over the last, you know, 10 or so years, if that even. And it's knowing what we know now, what can you do to make the sport safer? You know, it's understanding what the risks are. You know, one of the issues the players had is that the NFL, you know, as late as a few years ago, was still, you know, disseminating a pamphlet to the players saying that you know, there is no scientific proof of long-term ramifications from concussions if they're managed properly. That has changed, obviously, within the last couple of years, where they're now, you know, warning the players that you know, these can have long-term debilitating effects if they're not managed properly. And now I think everyone's coming to the realization of the risks that are involved, and you know, the idea is just to make everything as safe as possible, you know, without taking hitting out of football or even out of hockey.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you can take certain kinds of hits out. You know, I mean, some hits are just guaranteed to produce concussions, and others, you know, sometimes they produce concussions and sometimes they don't. But if you make the sport as safe as you can, and then you manage the concussions that remain in a proper way to minimize the damage. You know, I mean, you don't, and then you don't end up with stars out for like a year who, you know, because their concussions weren't managed properly.
Let's take another call. And someone here in Sydney, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Good. Kind of a two-part question, and then I'll give you some context. Can a small surface area on impact on the head at high velocity cause a concussion that might exhibit damage in terms of dementia later in life? Here's the context. My dad had a bullet go through his helmet and graze his skull without penetrating the skull in World War II, and now is severely demented. So The bullet was a high velocity. Obviously, it's small, so the impact area was small. But there is this severe dementia condition now. Please take it and run.
Well, you know, probably, you know, his dementia isn't traced back to a single event, although that is possible. I mean, there's plenty of evidence in the scientific literature that shows that a hit to the head increases your risk of dementia. But, you know, we've always had this condition, shell shock, you know, that we've known about, where people came back from wars kind of messed up. And, you know, it's being, you know, maybe hit by the bullet, but also being there when there were explosions and being thrown around. You know, the great possibility is that there were multiple concussions during the war, that, you know, there was a cumulative effect.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks. And I'm sure this is difficult because we know we have plenty of people who suffer with dementia who have never been in a war. So I think the big question, I think, continues to be, what is dementia? What is it all about? What causes it? I'm not sure we really have much in the way of answers still.
Well,
for that.
Also, there's the issue of, you know, there's genetics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people's brains are probably just much more resilient than other people's. And those people can take hits to the head and not develop dementia. But if you look at the brains, you know, that the Boston University people have autopsied, I mean, you can see the damage to the, I mean, some of them are so bad that, you know, without even a microscope, you can see the damage.
Mm-hmm.
It's very intense.
But certainly here, at least in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of attention to the subject of traumatic brain injury that was a result of people's experience in war.
Right.
I think probably more has been learned about what can happen as a result. Are there some ways in which actually looking at that work has helped people who are interested in sports-related head injuries to try and to be able to understand that a little bit better?
I actually think it's the other way around.
Oh, okay.
That you know, the Army has used sports as a model.
Hmm.
You know, there was soldiers are soldiers. There's been this attitude, oh, well, you know, you got up, you dusted yourself off, and you went back to the war. But, you know, at some point people realized that soldiers were coming back, Marines, who were damaged in some way. And at that point people started looking at what had been learned from, you know, this sort of natural lab that is sports. You know, we have people there, they're being concussed over and over and over again, and we see what the effect is, and we see how best to treat it. You know, which has, because the Army has and the Marines have looked at this, you know, there have been changes, you know, more emphasis on taking people out and letting them rest if they've had a concussion, rather than just saying, well, you know, war is hell, get back out there.
Hmm. We have another caller here to talk with. Let's go to Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Great show. Great information, great guest. I appreciate the information and look forward to reading your book. Having my own 14-year-old who is very active in football, being one of them, I have a great appreciation for not wanting him to get hurt. But I had a question that I guess my question would be, so at what point or what are you guys advocating here? I mean, are you advocating the eradication of football and hockey and, you know, very violent sports like that? I know that there have been great advances in the equipment, but like you guys discussed earlier, some equipment is now used almost as weapons in the game itself. I mean, and then you made the analogy to cigarette smoking, and now we're trying to eradicate the use of tobacco. It's a socially acceptable device. So is that where you're going with this? Is that what you think that...
I don't think so. I mean, you know, people make choices. You know, anytime you walk out of your house and you get in your car, you're taking a risk. You know, I mean, you can't live your life and protect yourself from every possible risk. but you can deal with those risks intelligently. You know, you can take an intelligent viewpoint towards concussions, towards recognizing them and treating them properly and minimizing the damage, and you can try to change rules in various sports to lessen the number of concussions. I mean, part of what has to change is the macho attitude. I mean, I'm not a big football fan. I watch football, but you know, I'm into equestrian events, and what I've noticed is that, you know, you take cross-country jumping, nobody wants to make the jumps come apart, you know, which would be safer for both the horses and the riders, because it just wouldn't be the same. You know, how is this a test of the horse and the rider? And I say, I want the horse and the riders to survive the event. You know, and what needs to change is this total macho attitude towards people's health and the health of their brains.
Well, and I guess I could appreciate that. I mean, but I, you know, isn't it, you're trying to change, you know, an evolutionary state that has occurred for a long time to make it socially acceptable today.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, the discussion of soldiers in war, you know, and I have to say, I thought it was treated a little flip that, you know, oh, you know, to tell a soldier, oh, you're hurt, just get up and get out there. Well, of course, you're in war. The other guy's trying to kill you. If you don't get up and get out there, you're going to get killed. But I think to some extent, football is, you know, the closest equivalent to preparing boys for going to war in a socially acceptable context. You know, so anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this point, but it's a very interesting conversation, and I look forward to reading books.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, I think that really, you know, listening to this conversation, if you're a parent and you have children who play sports, that's going to be the bottom line question. Do I let my son or my daughter play?
Well, I'm not stopping my daughter from playing soccer, and of course that may change. Who knows? You know, she's still in that sort of weevil soccer phase where they kind of bounce off each other, and you know, they're little, they don't have so much mass going into the collision. But, you know, I also might let her play. That's because I think there's a lot of benefit that you get from playing in sports. But ultimately, you know, whether it's war or whether it's football or soccer, you know, there may be times when, say, you're at war and you can't stop and take care of the concussion because you're being bombed. But there's a lot of times when you can stop and take care of things properly, and certainly when you're playing sports, you have that ability to take care of things. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you this, because here, clearly, the four young athletes, their first line of defense, protecting them from injury, should indeed be their parents. And given that we have this problem here with concussion being something that it's maybe hard to diagnose or you can't really be sure, there are now people who are rushing in knowing that here's an opportunity to sell somebody a product, to create a product and sell it, something that would, and I don't know, we're talking about just here better helmets or helmets that have some kind of sensors built into them or something like that, some way that technology can give you the advantage. And, you know, put a little, what you'd like to have is a helmet that has a little red light on it that's, you know, when the person has a concussion, the light will go on. And so you can have an indicator and you can look at that kid and say, okay, you're done. Is there any hope that such a thing might actually work and help?
Well, that would be nice. I don't see it happening anytime in the near future, but I do agree that, you know, parents are in the front lines of taking care of their kids. And, you know, you're a parent, you know your kid. You know if your kid's a little bit off, you know, and if that happens after a practice, then you have to pay attention. You know, you're the one who knows if your kid seems a little slow or just their behavior seems a little odd, they're not sleeping right. I mean, that is, you know, maybe it's not a concussion, but it's better to check it out than not. You know, you can, if you can't be there for all the practices, and none of us can, or all the games, you know, you're there when you can be there, and otherwise, you know, you're following up with questions. Mm.
And then, of course, there is another person involved here, and that's the coach. And as a parent, I'm hoping that this person will have my child's welfare at heart and would put that above winning the game. How are we doing in terms of educating coaches, particularly the people who coach youth sports on this issue?
I think one of our reasons for writing this book was the hope that we would educate more people. And even if the coaches didn't necessarily read it, maybe the parents would read and would then go put pressure on the coaches. You know, it's, you know, there are people, and certainly in the book, who got into it with their kids' coaches because the coaches were too aggressive. You know, I'd like to think I could trust the coach, but I don't 100% trust the coach, my kid's coach, to keep her out of a game after head injury if she's a really good player and there's a championship on the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're here at the point where we just about have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so left. So what, for people who are listening, particularly people who have children who do play these sports, what thought would you like to leave with them?
Well, they're the ones who are taking care of their kids' brains. You know, I mean, they have to understand that neither their kids nor the coaches and sometimes not even the trainers are going to be looking out for their kids as much as mom and dad are.
And David, you want to add anything to that?
No. Linda covered it, I think.
Okay. Well, that's it's something I think it's obviously a really significant issue, and as we said, it's something that's starting to get the attention that probably it deserves. And I wonder whether you think, in fact, if it does get more attention on with professional athletes, that'll then also help trickle down to get more attention to younger players.
Well, that's certainly the NFL is the most popular sports league out there. It's where this issue took hold. What they do, both good and bad, sets the standard that kids emulate, that coaches follow. But by the same token, the risk reward for professional athletes is different than it is for youth athletes, and there has to be kind of a trickle up as well that it's you don't wait for the NFL to set standards that in terms of concussion management and safety.
Yeah, well, that's where we'll leave it. Again, for people who want to read more on the subject, you can look for the book we've mentioned by our guest, Linda Carroll, David Rosner. The title is The Concussion Crisis, Anatomy of a Silent Epidemic. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Linda, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.